Accession number 32380, Reel 3.
Yeah, talking foreign.
Do you speak Albanian now with a...
I speak Albanian, it's my daughter.
Do you speak it with an English accent?
Well, no, I don't. I speak with a good Albanian.
I was going to ask your daughter about your daughter. She's bilingual, is she?
Well, I would love to think that she's bilingual, but she's more of an English little girl. She understands everything I speak to, I say to her, but she doesn't speak Albanian. And even if she speaks, she's got a very strong English accent. She's only three.
And is your partner English?
She's English, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I was going to just ask you quickly about about your faith and the kind of element that's had in your life.
Well, it was quite interesting because the faith in Kosovo, it's it. Albanians in general, we've got a very strong Albanian identity that overrules every religion that we belong to. Because Albanians are not identified as one religion nation. We've got three main religions. We are Catholics, we are Orthodox, we're Greek Orthodox, not, you know, presenting Orthodox, and Muslims. And, you know, there were different stages of the religion, because originally we were all Catholics. Not Catholics, but just Christians. Then in the 11th century, when the church was divided, it divided, you know, East and West. And for some reason, it divided Albanians in half. Half of Albanians were Orthodox, half were Catholics. And then, until the 15th century, there was no Muslims around. When Ottomans invaded, you know, Eastern Europe and most of the Central Europe, then they stayed there 500 years. So they managed to convert a huge majority of the population into, you know, Muslim. But because we were resisting, you know, Ottomans as well as Serbia, as well as Greece, as well as everybody, Romans and even Bulgarians, we were invaded by that and stuff. Because we were, you know, resisting these foreign invaders, the national identity was so strong that religion was just a way of surviving, basically. And a lot of people, you can find a lot of names within Albanian community, within Kosovo, as well as Albania, that they have, the first name is Catholic, the second name is Muslim, or the other way around, you know, just to survive and to please the occupiers whilst they were doing their own business. So I feel, first of all, I feel Albanian of Muslim creed. As we speak, I'm fasting. It's the month of Ramadan. But I'm doing that out of my choice because I would like to, you know, I feel quite comfortable of living my life as a Muslim man. And but yeah, the religion had very little part in my life. And until I was 19, I didn't even thought about fasting or praying or doing anything.
You weren't particularly religious?
I wasn't growing up. No, not at all. My family was not, and they're still not, you know, very religious. But, you know, we do bits of the religion. Mm. You know, we do fast. You know, we keep Ramadan, and we celebrate Eid and stuff. And, you know, so there are bits of religion that we like to follow. But, you know, after Ramadan, I'd like an old beer here and there and stuff like that. I'm not old, but quite a lot. But, yeah, so but I'd like to, you know, just be a little bit of Muslim.
Do you think your experiences in being forced out of your country and becoming a refugee have affected your faith, your perception of your religion, or not?
No, not at all.
As you were saying, the Serbs started playing on this element. Yeah, did that force anything onto you?
No, it didn't make me feel any more or less, you know, religious as I was. Well, I mean, when you're scared and when you're, you know, when you face death, you do feel more religious and you pray to God and you do all these things. But that's just temporarily. But no, it didn't have any effect.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, it didn't have any effect. Because the religion was not strongly imposed by my family and stuff. And it was not part of, you know, it didn't play a huge part of my life or my family life. Probably I can speak for the majority of Albania's life. You know, the religion is just... I never managed to find a right word. It's not... It's like a second... wasn't that, you know, if your identity, you know, if you want to identify yourself first as whatever, because here in Britain, for example, in England, people want to identify themselves as British, but Welsh and Scottish, they want to identify themselves as, you know, first Scottish and then British. Albanians, they rebuild their creed, they want to be identified as Albanians first, and then the religion is something that, you know, is quite personal. And
okay.
We just want to be left alone.
And what's your attitude to Serbia now? I mean, did you follow him a lot of
this
trial?
To be honest with you, I follow news really, really closely, and even nowadays, even after Milosevic's death, you know, I follow news very closely, and I hate the bonus to death, to be honest with you, but it's not Serbia's fault, it's the politics. Because even these days, the very pro-European, moderate government that they have, they're fighting so hard, they're spending millions of money to campaign against Kosovo independence and Albania and Kosovan state. And that's the follow-up of the Milosevic's regime, because it was Milosevic who changed the constitution.
He had this,
of Serbia.
This perception that Kosovo is the heartland of Serb.
Oh, yeah.
With the battle and...
Yes, yes, yeah, exactly,
the
exactly.
Churches and...
Yeah. He started the whole thing, and he changed the constitution of Serbia, and revoked the autonomy of Kosovo. And now Serbia, to these days, the very moderate and pro-European government, is fighting Milosevic's war in Kosovo. Because they're saying that according to our constitution, Kosovo is part of Serbia, and according to our heritage, Kosovo is in the part of Serbia, and we will never, ever, ever going to let Kosovo go. Which, in fact, Kosovo is a process of breaking up, dating back from Ottoman Empire. You know, a lot of little countries came out of that big empire, and Yugoslavia came as part of that empire, and now breaking up of Yugoslavia, Kosovo is part of the process. It's not, you know, a heartland of anybody's. And it's, yeah.
That's just third propaganda.
Exactly, it is.
And how do you see the future of Kosovo as an independent country?
Well, loads has to be done, to be honest with you. And we're not going to be able to survive without foreign investors in the country, because we have loads of resources. We've got the biggest reserve of coal in probably Europe. More than Wales.
Wow.
Honestly, it's huge. And we've got a lot of mines, you know, we've got a lot of zinc, copper and gold, you know, but the mines haven't been, they didn't work for the last 20 years. So you need, reopening a mine is just like creating a new mine somewhere. So huge investments need to be done. And Kosovo itself, the government hasn't got money. I mean, 2 years ago, the Kosovo's budget was about 500 million euros, which was less than Man United. So it was, it's still very, very new, really, really poor. But instead of being drained by Yugoslavia and later on Serbia, because all the resources were drained, nothing was invested in Kosovo, at least now we can sell what we have to foreign investors, and after a few years' time, we might be able to, you know, be, you know, rich enough to open our own mines and, you know, doing business to ourselves. There is a huge potential of workforce in Kosovo at the moment. For example, a lot of countries, Europeans, you know, the countries near where we are, they are just waiting for the final stages to be sorted and to have some sort of security. We have applied for membership on the International Monetary Fund, as well as the World Bank, and the applications have been accepted, and it's a long process before we are accepted as a member of. So if we get that membership, you know, the financially we will have more security, and people will be able to invest in the country. And at the moment, it's, you know, the poorest country in Europe. The wages are really, really cheap, and it's more feasible for Germany, Italy, France, England, and stuff to have factories and places in Kosovo than in China, because customs are really close, to travel the goods and the workforce, it's quite cheap, you know, at the moment, I'm not saying that that's how it should be, but the average wage in Kosovo is about 300 euros,
okay.
Which is just under £200. And, I mean, even if they pay somebody 400 euros, it's quite a good wage, you know, for Kosovo standards. It works for, you know, Western countries. So there's loads of people who want to invest in Kosovo. And another thing, there's about 80% of Kosovo population are under 35 years of age, working for, so people are just crying for something to do. And there's loads of workforce and stuff, because it's a really young population. It's very young. And there's loads of potential there. And I really see a good future. It will take some time, obviously, because, you know, Serbia's not going to give up that easily. They've got Russia, their side, and China and India, you know, to fight their cause. You know, Security Council and people on bodies. But we've got Britain and America and Canada and Australia. So.
And just one quick last question about your work here. It's really interesting that you work for an organisation that helped you.
I know. Isn't that
interesting? And did you,
interesting.
Talk about that first.
Yeah, I can tell you, because I didn't have a concept of charities at all before I came here, because there was no charities back in Kosovo, in Yugoslavia at the time. And when I came here, you know, refugees, they were really good to us, and they were doing their job, but there were loads of volunteers. There were more volunteers than just paid staff, you know, just helping us. And then I was volunteering on the reception, just helping people and just doing stuff. I used to work really, really hard for years and years and years, and just all of a sudden coming here, just sitting there and being fed, it felt not right.
Yeah.
So I was just doing anything, to be honest. You know, I was joining and I was trying to maintain things and sweep outside and cut the grass and do things, you know.
To give you something to do.
Just to give myself something to do. And then I was volunteering, you know, the refugee action, every time they had staff training and stuff, they used to include me on the training as well. Although it was quite hard to understand what's going on because my English was quite limited. I was part of that and I learned a few bits, and then they advertised for a bilingual project worker to work with the Kosovo community. So I applied for the job and thought, I'll give it a shot. And I didn't get it. So then after a few months, it was madness when I think back. I really didn't have experience. They wanted, you know, a project worker who would assist people to go to different places and advocate on people's behalf and stuff. I did it myself. And I was not able to do it. But, you know, I tried, and they shortlisted me out of their goodness of their heart. They just could give me that chance. Then they advertised again, and I applied again. And I got an interview. I didn't get the job again. And then I carried on volunteering still. And then after I moved to Derby, I did two volunteers in two places I volunteered. One for, it was Department of Social Services working with children with learning difficulties. They were mainly children with Down syndrome. So I was just assisting, you know, the trainers or teachers or social workers, whatever. So I was doing that once a week. And then I was volunteering for NHS as well, you know, just interpreting for free, you know, for people. Then there was another vacancy in the refugee. I applied, I didn't get it. Then the fourth time, there was a vacancy for 4 months as a post-settlement officer or whatever in Kosovo program again. So by then I learned, you know, I improved my language because I was doing ESOL classes as well. You know, working, volunteering in different places. So I you know, my knowledge improved quite good. Then I got a job for 4 months. And then after 4 months, with my status, you know, changing and all that, I couldn't afford to be without a job. So I applied for a job here in Bristol. And I got the job and I moved because of the job here. So then I worked as a caseworker for 4 years. And then I did a course at Bristol City of College. Management course. I did a certificate in management studies. I was able to, because I was working full time, and I still didn't have a status. I was on a working visa, so I paid overseas fees, was one year, about £2,200 or something like that, that I think had to be stalwarts. And I did the course, and then there was a vacancy here for deputy manager, and I applied. I didn't get the job. I applied a second time, I didn't get the job. I applied a third time, and I got a job as a deputy manager. And I've been deputy manager since 2004.
Do you find it a frustrating job?
It is. It's really demanding.
Just describing, as you were, the status that you went through. I mean, I don't understand how the immigration system works, and English is my first language.
Mm. I mean, nowadays, things are even worse, for these days. Refugees come today, because there are loads of hostility from everybody. Starting from the system, from the media, from a lot of people in the street. I mean, having said that, there's loads of people who are volunteer for us, and majority of the population don't hassle refugees, but there are individuals, there are groups that give them a hard time and stuff. And the thing that they go through is just horrendous. Because, as I said myself, we came quite well organised and everything was provided for us. And I find it so hard to integrate and be part of the society because of what I've been through. But these days, people coming here, being harassed from the day that they come into the country, and they go through hundreds of interviews with immigration and the police, and their benefits or support gets stopped and end up on the street, and in the foreign country it's horrendous. And it's very frustrating because we are charity, we've got open doors for clients that they come here. And sometimes, most of the times, unfortunately, we have nothing to offer to people. We say, the only thing we can offer you, which is not really an option that they're giving you, but that's the only offer we can have them to go back home.
Okay.
And for some people, it's a terrifying thought, to go back home voluntarily. We say, that's the last thing you can do, because the government is not allowing you to stay here. They are not giving you any entitlement to any benefits or any support or anything. And we've got some food that we get from donations, as you can see here, that we give to some people who are really, really desperate. But that's as much as we can do. So it's quite frustrating. I don't see clients as much face to face at the moment, but I have to support case managers, and they get really frustrated. And sometimes I manage them. Operation side of work. So I deal with clients when they're quite desperate. And there are people who are really, really desperate, and they don't want to hear what the case workers are telling them. So I have to deal with that. And so it's just frustrating, but I enjoy what I'm doing.
Yeah.
Because I feel like I'm able to one, contribute to what I've got. From this country, from people here, I'm able to do the same thing, for people who are, who are in the middle, less fortunate than me.
Because you have seen the positive side of it, haven't you? And the negative,
Exactly. And now I feel, in a way, I feel part of this country, this stuff, and I feel like it's my job, it's my duty to, help the less unfortunate, and this is the job I'd like in. Yeah, and I think I'm going to carry on for a few more years. Yeah.
Okay, on that note. Have we covered everything that you think we should,
I really think, I don't think I'm left